Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Why is it important that we have businesses that are growing? I don't create jobs sitting in Downing Street. It's your business that is creating jobs and opportunities for people up and down the country. So if I want to deliver that vision that I talked about, that vision where every young person can grow up and have an amazing life, right, and where every family can build a better future for themselves, I need businesses to flourish, to grow, to create all those jobs and opportunities and well-paid jobs everywhere in the country.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, Rishi Sunak, like most politicians, is adamant that he can grow the economy by getting businesses to be more productive. But can businesses really grow the economy by themselves if the government just gets out of the way? You might think that by employing more people or creating more widgets or whatever it is you make, you are helping the economy. But there's one big constraint: how much money people have to spend. So today we talk about the one simple truth: the economy is constrained by how much money there is. So how do we get around that? That's today on the Debunking Economics Podcast. So can you actually grow an economy without growing the money supply? So Steve, a friend of mine, I had this conversation, this was months ago now, saying that he is growing the economy because he employs people. His business, we know, it's a bit like Rishi Sunak was saying in that introduction, because his businesses have all gone very well. This is an Australian billionaire friend. And he says, you know, he creates money for the Australian economy. But is he actually, if the amount of money in the economy is fixed and it changes hands at the same speed? We'll look at the velocity of money and all that sort of stuff. But let's assume money changes hands in the economy at the same speed. And let's say he's not selling overseas and bringing in foreign money, because that obviously is an extra source of money. He's just selling domestically. Then the money he is taking away from, the money he's making, I should say, he's taking away from other businesses, isn't he? Because basically the amount of money that can be spent buying his stuff is determined by the amount of money that people have. So, you know, which is the income. So he can't make money unless he's taking money away from another business, because there's only so much money to be spent.
Yeah, if his bank account's going up and there's a fixed amount of money, or the let's start with that assumption first of all, then if his account goes up, somebody else has to go down by precisely as much. And in fact, a little booklet that, you know, is being used by that marketing firm to market the online lectures that I'm giving, Funny Money, I actually make that case with a trio of American billionaires, not your Aussie mate, but a few in the Midwest America somewhere, Tom, Dick and Harry, who decide to create their own monetary system. And they're doing a little experiment, but they find they're actually in touch with the multiverse through their mate chief researcher, Dr. Strangelove. And they think, well, we're going to see what happens if you have a fixed money supply and you don't allow any creation of money. And they then find it mysterious that when one of their bank accounts goes up, the other one goes down by precisely as much. And they start accusing each other of fraud and robbery and so on and so forth. But it's just, if there's a fixed amount of the stuff, then it can be in one person's account. If one person goes account, somebody else's has to go down. So he's not making money. He's accumulating more of the money than other people have.
So why do people like Rishi Sunak have a great deal of difficulty with this? Because you think that, you know, all many conventional economists, this idea that businesses can add to the money supply because they are creating more jobs when it's still the same amount of money. So, and if you think about, you know, how we measure GDP, at its base level, it's sometimes based on output and it's sometimes based on expenditure. And it actually really doesn't matter, because they should both be the same, shouldn't they?
Well, that's the whole idea. I mean, this is one thing which when I first tried to bring credit, the role of credit into aggregate demand, which in credit being how the private sector creates money, private banks, I started with a sort of starting notion of GDP being income plus change in debt. Now, that's wrong, but the insight led me to a correct answer, which Michael Hudson and I worked out together, and that is that GDP is effectively turnover of existing money plus new money created either by credit, which is private money creation, or by the government, which is fiat money creation. So if you don't have either of the latter two happening, then there's just a set amount of money in the economy, isolated from what happens with foreign exchange, exports and imports and capital transfers.
And we'll get on to that. Yeah.
Yeah. But if his bank account's going up, everybody else is going down by precisely the same amount.
So when businesses are told by politicians that they are going to get rid of the red tape and that's going to increase their output, it's going to increase their earnings, all it's going to do, that red tape is going to help some, and some businesses might be more productive. All of this strive for productivity in an economy isn't going to help. You can simplify regulations and do whatever you want to try and make it easier for businesses to succeed. All you'll be doing is helping some businesses, but not all, because there's still, making the same point again, still only the same amount of money to spend.
Yeah, I mean, what they're doing, they're taking away the green red tape and bragging about that, but they're taking away the green tape as well. And that's the problem. And if you don't have money, without fail, you look through history, very few economies have grown for any period of time without also having a growing money stock. So, and again, we've got the usual climate change caveat about the benefits of a growing economy. But if that's the framework you're working on, and Sunak is obviously working in that framework, then if you want to boost the economy, you've got to boost the supply of money as well. You have banks that are no longer lending on anything like the scale they did before the financial crisis, which in some ways is a good thing because they mainly lend for speculation rather than investment. But if Sunak is also trying to run a budget surplus, he's cutting the green tape as well as cutting the red tape.
Well, yeah, because that is the point, isn't it? So because the only way that you're going to get businesses to be more successful is by having people spend more, which means they've got to have more money. And the only way I can have more money, unless I borrow from the bank, and that is a short-term measure, is that I have to pay less tax to the government. And if that means, I mean, if the government taxes me less, then of course that would mean that the money that they were spending is now being spent by me. So that means no greater consumption, no more money in circulation, unless of course they keep spending at the same amount, which is when you get a government deficit, which is when we have more money. I mean, pure and simple. That, I mean, which is the MMT argument, really.
Yeah, and this is what is so frustrating, because economics, and the reason why does economics get itself in its knickers in a twist like this? And the basic reason is that they have a theory of the economy which leaves money out. So if you go back, I regard the fountainhead of neoclassical ideology and thought being Jean-Baptiste Say, who was one of the rivals to Ricardo when Ricardo was developing his classical approach to economics. And Say was one of somebody who said, value is utility. Say was saying, no, value is effort. So they're completely at loggerheads. But what we've accepted is Say's idea that money is irrelevant. What we've got is basically money is a veil over barter. You get rid of the veil, you see what's going on more clearly, and you can have an increase in the number of transactions at the barter level with no change in the amount of money. Now, that's a nice little theory. And as I think it wasn't Bertrand Russell, but it was one famous writer who said, the great tragedy of science is a beautiful theory destroyed by an ugly fact. And the ugly fact is, when you look at the data over the long term, there's been no real economic growth without monetary growth at the same time.
Well, the only way it could happen, isn't it, is if money is coming from elsewhere, or the speed of money changes, the velocity of money changes,
yeah.
Which we'll look at in a second. But just getting back to that idea, that pure GDP measure, that it doesn't matter whether you're measuring consumption or supply, they should both be the same. The money value in that is, if money only changed hands once a year, then that should be the same as well, shouldn't it?
If your velocity is stable, then any change in your monetary value of GDP has got to be changed by the amount of the stock of money. Now, velocity is not stable, but it isn't going in the right direction either. And just by getting ready to talk about this, I found a data series I've never seen before, maintained by the Federal Reserve, but they don't update it anymore. And it's what's that title it here? its velocity of money stock for the United States. It's got a very obvious acronym. It's A14187 USA 163 NNBR. So you're obviously going to remember that. And it's a very sensible acronym. Well, that peaked in 1880 at 5. So the money stock in the United States back in 1880, as they measured it here, turned over 5 times a year.
So if you had a dollar, you'd pass that to somebody else, they pass it to someone else. That would happen 5 times in a year.
5 times in 1 year, okay. And it looks like a roller coaster ride going down rather than up. And it when they stopped running the series, which was in 1966, good date to choose, it was down to 1.7.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's, you know, just pretty much the, you know, one-third the level of velocity it used to apply back in the 1880s. And funnily enough, Karl Marx in Capital, at one time, he was aware of the issue of the turnover of money as being a source for making a profit. And this is what your friend is confusing. It's the turnover of money that generates profit, not amount of money being created. But Marx was using a figure of 12. And I used to scoff and just sort of, you know, laugh about being so far out of touch with the actual numeric, because I'm used to it being about, in terms of the American data, about 1.8 was the average before the financial crisis and before the great financial bubbles began back in the 1980s. But 5 is in the ballpark of the 12 figure that Mark's using. So I think I owe Carl a bit of an apology.
Right. Well, maybe it was up to 12 at one point. Yeah, exactly. So, okay. So there's there might be worth, I mean, we talked about this once, and it was probably like 2 years ago or even 4 years ago. I've been doing this for so long.
But I know, losing track. Yeah.
You gave a great example of like the multiplier effect. So if you've got a static amount of money that's in the economy, and everyone's earning and spending, and it's not changing. If you inject some cash, you've got an opportunity to get a multiplier happening out of this. And you gave the example, I think it was someone going into a town in the Wild West or something. I don't know if you can recall this story where someone brings in.
That's a classic little internet meme. That one about a person going into puts down a deposit on a hotel room, I think it was. And then the concierge runs off and pays.
Well, first of all, before that, the moment before we go on there, that money he's bought. So it's about the economy of a town, which isn't getting any new money until this visitor arrives and pays that $200 deposit.
Yeah.
And then that's an injection into the economy in effect. Okay. So carry on from there.
Well, then what you have is he puts $200 down, reserving a hotel room. The concierge runs off and pays his outstanding bill to the prostitute. She goes and pays her rent. The landlord goes and pays off part of the debt that he owes to the bank. The bank issues a new loan. I'm making a story more complicated than it is in the internet meme. And then the bloke comes back and decides he's not going to stay, so he gets his $200 back. And what happens? He had a very high velocity of money for that period that paid off or that enabled a whole number of transactions to take place, which weren't possible before the money was injected into the system. And people say, how is this possible? And it's basically because we confuse the stock of money, which is dollars, with its turnover, which is GDP, which is dollars per year. And if you have a sudden boost in the dollars per year, then that can give you a boost in income with no change in the amount of money in existence. That's the answer to that particular internet meme. But the reality is the opposite, that except for COVID, when COVID struck, and also to some extent the financial crisis, the rate of creation of money has been slowing down, and so has its velocity.
Yeah. And so why is that? Why is it slowing?
I think a large part of it comes down to the fact we've got such a financialized economy that the people are in far more debt than was the case in the 1950s. I think when you look back at the capitalism's various phases, one of my old colleagues, actually, I've forgotten his name, David Levine, I think it was, wrote an article where he described the 1950s and 1960s as the golden age of capitalism. And in that sense, this is the sort of happy days world. And you look back and it's true because people were spending money quite freely. You had one income earner in most households, the male, wife at home sort of stuff. But there was, you know, it was sort of the happy days level of prosperity and carefreeness. And there was quite a high rate of turnover of money, much higher than like 1.8 to 2 at that stage, I think. And it's been trending down towards 1 and ever since, at the same time as we've got a huge increase in private debt. And I think what's going on, people are looking at their financial liabilities, the debt that they owe, because, you know, you borrow money from a bank, you get the money, but you also get the liability. And people's response to having that liability is to slow down how fast they spend, which means they individually think they're trying to accumulate more money in their bank accounts. Well, that works for the person who spends more slowly, but therefore means that the businesses that used to get that money don't get as much cash coming in the door. So they spend, their accounts go down in response to people spending less. So you have a fall in velocity of circulation because everybody's worried about paying their debts off.
Well, it's not just debt. It's not just debt, though, is it? It's also, you know, there'll be people who've got spare cash left at the end of the year and they say, OK, well, I'm going to put that into the pension. Or we're all putting money into private pension schemes as well now because, you know, because state pension schemes have, you know, worth diddly squat.
Been destroyed. Yeah.
So all of that money goes into the finance sector as well. Now, now people would say, well, it doesn't matter if it goes into the finance sector, Steve and Phil, because what does the finance sector do with it? It invests it, and that investment is going into business, and that's paying wages, so it all comes good at the end, which might be right. But, of course, that happens a lot slower than you giving me 10 quid and me getting off and spending it.
You get a lower – the finance sector the amount of time it takes – money to come out, you know, go into and come out of the finance sector is huge. It's a huge time lag. Whereas, as you say, if you're people spending in Main Street and not having to worry about the financial system, there's actually more turnover of money, more creation of economic activity from the same dollar. So, yeah, we've fallen for a huge con job that, you know, giving it to the finance sector will make the economy grow more rapidly. Instead, first of all, most of that money's gone into speculation on asset prices. It hasn't gone into genuine investment. And secondly, it slows things down. It doesn't speed things up. And then the finance sector takes its cut. So but that's that. What was that? Was the Leonardo DiCaprio movie? The Beast,
The Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah.
You know, where he's been.
It's a brilliant film.
It was real, truly brilliant. Matthew McConaughey doing the, you know, beat on the chest thing in the restaurant and saying, at this stage, you've got Dick Capriccio's character being quite naive and saying, oh, but, you know, the customer benefits as well. And he says, yeah, they think they do. You've got to keep them in the market and persuade them to buy this.
Oh, this is where you're selling penny stocks. Yeah.
And every time we do it, we take our cut and our money builds up and theirs goes down. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a con job.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, look, and on that whole thing about money going into the finance sector. So someone complained, I think it was from last week's podcast, that...
There's always a complaint.
There's always a, well, you know, more so. Like, I mean, normally directed at me, but actually this one was directed at you.
Well,
both of us actually talking about M1 and M4, and they said we tried to look it up and we're getting confused. So let's quickly, before the break, actually, we'll take a break. We'll keep that person listening through an ad. They can pay for the answer. And we'll look at the difference. And then I want to talk about, you know, other injections and things that move out of the economy as well. So almost like getting back to that GDP formula. We'll do that when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast. Me and Steve Keen, stay with us.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So we are looking at the money supply. Can you actually grow an economy if the money supply stays the same? And I think hopefully we've shown in the first half, unless you find some magic formula to increase the speed at which money changes hands? The answer to that is no. You can't increase the output of a country without increasing the supply of money. And then we started talking about how money goes into the finance sector. The only way around that, of course, is to increase the velocity of money. And actually, the opposite is happening. Money is slowing down. A lot of that is because it's going into the finance sector. So M1 and broad money, the definitions of all of these, Steve. So M1 is basically cash on hand, isn't it? It's either cash you got in your pocket or cash you got sitting in your bank. When we talk about broad money, that's where we're starting to include money that is sitting in term deposits, for example. I guess we'd want to see if we did want to, I'm imagining M1 money moves a lot faster than M4. So if you wanted to increase the velocity of your money in the your economy, then you want to increase the ratio of M1 to M4 money, wouldn't you? The proportion of M4 money that was actually M1.
Let's go back a bit for that listener, because money stocks are confusing. And one of the most confusing things about it, and I didn't realize this myself till about 20-something years ago, I suppose, that there used to be just three definitions. I think it was M0, M1, and M2. And M0 is not included in M1 and M2. That's something which, if you normally look at classifications, you think, oh, well, M0 is this amount, then M1 is M0 plus another thing, and M... No, that's not the case. And the reason for the
difference... So I hadn't even mentioned M0, so that's another one. So explain the difference between all of those, then.
Well, M0... You normally think, if you're somebody like working from a chemistry field or an engineering field, you'd imagine there's M0, M1, M2, then M0 is a restricted definition, M1 is slightly larger, and M2 is larger than that, blah, blah, blah. In fact, it's not, because there's money in circulation and there's money out of circulation. The widest way to think about money is that it's cash and coins plus the deposit accounts of the private banking system. Now, that's the liabilities of the banking system, which is the bank accounts, and it's the liabilities of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, because they respectively create coins and notes. Actually, the other way around, I think it's the Federal Reserve creates the notes and the Treasury creates the coins. It's a strange little divide of responsibility that virtually every country has. So it's the liabilities, the notes and coins, liabilities of the Treasury stroke central bank, and bank deposits, liabilities of the banking system. Now, balancing those liabilities are the assets of those three entities. Pardon me. And the assets of the banking sector consist of their deposits that they have at the central bank, the bonds they own, and the loans they've made to you, me, and everybody else in the economy. So and also the cash that they've got sitting in auto banks and vaults and stuff like that. So M0 is the cash that's held by the banking system. M1 is the money that's in circulation within the private sector, so the non-bank sector. So that's things like, again, that's cash, the coins and cash that you've got, plus check accounts, because there used to be a big difference between check accounts, which were called demand deposits, meaning you could go up to the bank and say, I want this money now, or you could give somebody a check using your checkbook, which we all used to own, and that check would be cleared instantly by the bank. There'd be no time lag, whereas savings accounts were supposed to be slower, and therefore savings accounts were treated as being part of M2. So you have M0, which fundamentally talks about money that is not in circulation, created and on the asset side of either the banking sector or the government, but not in circulation in the economy. M1, which is money that's in circulation in the economy and in immediately available accounts for people to spend. And then M2, which used to be more slowly accessible, but and then M1, M2 included M1. But M2 now, I mean, people don't even know that they have a distinction between savings accounts and check accounts. We all use our bank accounts.
They're almost the same thing. Exactly. Yeah. But then when you get into term deposits, that's where you start to get into the M3s and M4s then. That's money which is yours, but you don't have instant access to it.
Yeah. But again, people, what tends to happen during a boom is they become more and more liquid. And so you then get people basing transactions on them. So that gives you apparently more money in circulation. But as soon as there's a downturn, then the banks can slow down how fast you can access that money. People are less willing to accept it. So you get a variation in velocity coming out of it as well. So and the progression, the other side of the confusion over money, is that banks don't like being restricted. They're the ultimate libertarians. They want to do what they damn well like. And when they do that, we have a financial crisis most times as a result of it. So governments, after financial crisis, particularly after the Great Depression, basically said banks cannot use their money for any purpose they want. So in the 1920s, banks could purchase shares on the stock market. And that's partly where the huge bubble in stock market prices came from, then the crash afterwards. So after that period, banks that you and I have our deposit accounts, were banned from buying shares. And that's why banks created non-bank financial institutions, to let them speculate on all that sort of stuff. Then people have deposits with those accounts. And so they used to have M0, M1, and M2. Then we got M3. Then we got M4. Then they had broad money. Then, to a large degree, a lot of the statistical agencies have given up on tracking money numbers at all.
So the lower the number, excluding M0, the lower the number, then the faster the speed you'd assume on that money. So if you were trying to speed up the GDP for a country to try and ramp up consumption, you'd want to try and discourage people from having money sitting in anything higher than M2. Which would mean lower interest rates, presumably, sort of like, and some sort of incentive to drive consumption. Which, if you had a digital money supply, you might say, well, okay, the money's only going to be valid for a certain period of time, so you have to spend up quick. I mean, there's ways of getting that velocity up, aren't
there? Well, that's in fact one reason for the what's called the miracle of Wargl, I think it's WRGL.
Yeah.
Okay, which is a town
in Austria.
Town in Austria during the Second World War, which had the same unemployment rate as the rest of the Europe, with about 25% of people out of a job, rising right-wing sentiment, of course, coming out of that. And the mayor of Wargl was a fan of Silvio Gazelle, who was an Argentinian, I think, businessman who got involved in talking about monetary theory, got great respect from Keynes. And his argument was, you want money to turn over rapidly. So the way to do it is to have money which depreciates if it's just sitting in a bank account, not being used. So what the mayor of Wargl did was create a script which could be used to pay council rates and then also could be regarded as valid for commercial transactions in the municipality of Wargl. And what happened was this script, because if you didn't spend it, it depreciated, turned over at an incredible rate and drove the unemployment rate from Wargl from 25% down to zero. And then in came the central bank and banned it because, you know, we're the only ones allowed to create official money. So they ended the experiment, which put Wargl back into the 25% unemployment levels. And lately, it wasn't too long before they were saying Heil Hitler. So it is a real example of how Gazellian money, which depreciates, and of course that's to some extent what inflation does, actually encourages a higher rate of turnover.
Right. So if money is depreciating just by, you know, by its very nature, and you have constrained the money supply, then you are actually you'll just see an economy slide.
No. The other way, because you've got to be creating the additional money as well. This is what the Wargl experiment did. The stuff you've got depreciates, you then spend it very highly, and then you won't need to get the next injection and the next injection. So it relies upon the combination of the two.
But if you didn't do that and you just had a static money supply, money will, you're going to get some sort of inflation happening within the economy for whatever reason. People just might just naturally assume that things are going to cost more. You're going to see prices, even if it's ever so slight, ever so slow. If you've constrained the money supply, your consumption is going to get less. Prices will slowly increase. You've still only got the same amount of money supply. You're going to, you know, at the best, the economy is going to be static. In reality, the economy is probably going to slide.
In fact, what you get is sliding prices and sliding transactions. And this is one of it's a slightly off topic what we're talking about today, but one little paper I've written, which I'm going to be distributing, I think, through Substack and Patreon shortly, is looking at what I call Fisher's paradox. And that was that Fisher said one of the reasons that the Great Depression was so extreme was that people were massively in debt, because they'd borrowed money to gamble on the stock market. Stock market crashes, business collapses. people's response was to try to pay their debts down. But as they paid their debts down to the banks, that also reduced the money supply. And Fisher said, because the reduction in prices and the reduction in transactions are a double whammy, the more debtors pay, the more they owe. And I've simulated that in Minsky and found that he's quite right, that as you have people trying to pay their private debt down, that reduces GDP by more than it reduces the outstanding debt levels. So even as transactions are falling, the debt to GDP ratio is rising. And you don't want to, that's deflation. You don't want to be caught in that particular trap. But the idea of the Gazellian currency is a currency which depreciates, but you have to therefore continue replenishing it.
Well, in this non-Gazellian world, where we are, where we find ourselves, with a government that is trying to reduce the supply of money by, you know, by
running a surplus.
By running a surplus, exactly. So they, you know, are pushing for greater productivity, which they're never going to achieve. So, for example, all this talk about automation, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? We'll have fewer people employed, but companies might be more productive, the companies that are well automated, but their output still has to be sold, but you can only sell to people who have the money to buy. So if you've got less people who've got money, but you're, then your market is going to be smaller, or the rich would have to buy everything that you produce. So that creates a quandary as well, doesn't it? You could actually see in that scenario, automation might actually make the economy slide because there's less people with money to buy your stuff.
Yeah, and also to invest in the automation, guess what? You've got to have money. And, you know, so you either borrow the money or you have it out of retained earnings, and the latter's only going to be feasible if you have a high rate of turnover of money and creation of money by the government. So again, you've got this, you know, this is why they make the red tape versus green tape. Cutting red tape is fine. Cutting green tape is disastrous. But because governments have fallen for mainstream economics and they believe the government deficit actually takes money away from the public, which is the exact opposite of the truth. It injects money into private bank accounts. Because they're trying to run a surplus and save money, they're actually destroying the money the rest of us are used to spending, and therefore people are less likely to spend, so the economy slows down. So you watch this stuff and it's just insane to see.
So historically, because money supply has to increase. For the economy to grow, the money supply has to increase. That means either people borrowing more from banks or the government spending more than it's bringing in taxation. But historically, what's happened? So the mint and the treasury, whoever's creating notes and whoever's creating coins, you know, the conventional form of money printing, before we had electronic banking, before everything was sitting on a spreadsheet, presumably the way back then was that they would just print more money depending on how much they'd like to see in circulation. But how was that accounted for in the past?
That is actually what they call seigniorage. And it's got a complicated definition because seigniorage, people would think it's like if it costs you 5 cents to print a dollar note, then the seigniorage is 95 cents. But the way the Bank of England defines it, and I think it's as common to central banks, is they define it as the interest on the amount of money they've created. So they create a pound note. If the interest rate is 5%, they call the seigniorage 5% rather than the whole pound. But I think fundamentally, when you look at the accounting of this, if you are creating banknotes, which when you create them, they're an asset for you, they've got a cost of production. So when the Bank of England creates banknotes, literally printing money, then I would regard that as being, let's say they create £1 billion, and the £1 billion costs, say, and this is an exaggeration, £1 billion costs £1 million to produce, then there's a £999 million increase in the equity of the Bank of England out of doing that. But then when the notes are in circulation, of course, when people ask for the notes, you then have banks asking to buy the notes because they need the notes to hand out through auto tellers and things like that. So they would then sell a bond, and the bond would they'd then get, say, $1 billion increase in their reserves, and then give that $1 billion in reserves to the Bank of England in return for $1 billion worth of notes, which then turn up in their vaults, and then that gets taken out by the public. It's complicated, isn't it?
It is. Well, I feel like there's a whole episode on this in itself. But I mean, it's so the extra money that's gone in circulation, is it actually money that people are paying to have that cash? then that's not new money, is it? That's just a transfer. But they must have in the past been saying, well, okay, we feel like there needs to be more money in the economy. So if they're doing that, it's sitting on their balance sheet. Is it a bit like a paper equivalent of quantitative easing in that respect?
Well, yeah, but what it's a paper equivalent of running a deficit. And this is the government, this is one time where normally I object to MMT's argument about consolidating the central bank and the treasury. But I think it makes sense when you're trying to talk about things like notes. So if you imagine the government prints notes and then spends those notes, that is creating money, injecting into the economy and increasing economic activity, because people then give the government goods in return for that money, then they've got that money, which then can be turned over in the private sector economy as well.
But there's no difference, is there, between the government saying, well, we're going to create a note. We're going to create a $1 trillion note. There's no difference to that and saying we're going to issue $1 trillion worth of bonds and then the central bank buys up those bonds. I mean, it's the same.
I mean, well, there's a thing, I think they're not called concert. I looked at them some time ago, and I've forgotten the name now. But there is a British note which backs the pound notes produced by the Bank of Scotland. I don't think it's called a consol, but it's something like that. And that's got a face value of £100 million. And I'd love to go shopping with those, but they simply sit in what's called Threadneedle Street in the Bank of England. You can't take them out of there. But they one for one balance the pounds. £20 notes and £10 notes and so on, created in Scotland by the bank. Is it the Royal Bank of Scotland that does that? The strange Scottish notes.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the sort of case of everything in banking is assets and liabilities. So the fact that the Royal Bank of Scotland creates these pound notes is backed by the asset that is then held by the. You can't do this verbally. You've got to have.
Right. And I feel like it's a bit of a rabbit hole when we're going down here.
It gets very, and like even I get confused. I'm trying to look at double entry bookkeeping tables in my head.
By the way, I think I think it's not just the Royal Bank of Scotland. I think Clyde's Bank creates notes as well. Then it's tied to one particular bank.
Yeah, a few banks.
Yeah, but anyway, so moving on to how else money can be created. So if we're looking at the UK, for example, and this again gets back to the GDP equation, exports obviously help. So I think I'm an example here. I mean, I live in England, but the majority of what I earn comes from Australia. So almost all the money I spend is incremental to the UK money supply, isn't it? Because,
that's very true. Yeah. And that's the one reason I object to one. I completely agree with MMT when it comes to discussing the government's capacity to create money in its own currency. But they have this, in my opinion, crazy line: exports are a cost, imports are a benefit, and they wave away the impact that this has on the domestic money supply. But in your case, you're being paid in Australian dollars. That gets transferred from an Australian bank to a bank in the UK, which then hands those Australian dollars to the Bank of England in return for British pounds at the equivalent exchange rate. So fundamentally, you're boosting the British money supply by being paid out of Australia.
Yeah. So, which is a good thing. Rather sad, though, isn't it?
For Britain.
For Britain, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But rather sadly, of course, I'm a rare example because we export services in the UK. So I think I'm trying to find...
Which is what you're doing.
Yeah. So we've got a services surplus of 39 billion, but a goods trade deficit for goods of 48 billion. So more of our money is actually going overseas. So unless we do something about it, getting back to Rishi Sunak, unless we do something about it, actually...
You're running out of money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Our money supply is shrinking. So therefore, there's less money to spend. Therefore, the economy goes down the gurgler.
And
so
then what you would need in that case is a government to be doing the opposite and running a deficit. What are they doing? Trying to run a surplus. So so what you've got is you have three fundamental ways you can boost the money supply in the country. You can have exports exceeding imports. So you get the sort of cash injection you're creating by loudmouth. You can have the government spending more than it gets back in taxation, and of course they're doing that, but they're trying to do the opposite. Or you can have banks lending out more than they get back in repayments. Now, if they were lending for productive industry, wouldn't be so bad. But what they're normally lending for is house price bubbles and share price bubbles. So yeah, you're not
that,
adding...
But that does, yeah. I know, which is not ideal, is it? Because it slows things down. But, I mean, it's still new money, isn't it? But then it's... So even if I went and you know, borrowed money to buy a house, which I have to pay more for than I would otherwise because the bank is lending too much money for people buying houses, so you get an asset bubble. They're still selling the house at that high price to somebody else who's getting that money. So the money is still in circulation. It's just perhaps moving slower, and we're all, you know, paying a ridiculous price for our houses. It's still creating money. But it's still only temporary, though, isn't it? Because at some point I'll pay that back, and then that money gets destroyed again.
Well, potentially, but that when that happens, you have a credit crunch, and that's you know, we had back in 2008 on a grand scale. But like it's a very when you look at how Schumpeter thought banks did operate or should operate, he saw them creating money for entrepreneurs and creating, you know, he said, you know, everybody gets their money out of the circulation of existing activities except the entrepreneur who's got a great idea but no money. So they get money from the bank that adds to the level of economic demand in the economy. And so long as various conditions are met about, you know, the entrepreneurial idea not boosting in the prices more than it boosts total turnover of goods, et cetera, the entrepreneur comes out ahead, so ahead, and so does the economy. But that's not what's happening. We have the basically we have the private banking sector is financing asset bubbles, and the government is trying not to create new money at all, and then they're telling the private sector to grow.
Which is strange, isn't it? Because the, you know, even if you just went to your very first economics lesson and then lost interest or thought it was all rubbish, you'd probably do that equation for GDP, which is, you know, all about, well, what's the GDP for a nation? It's, you know, how much money we spend buying stuff, how much companies invest in equipment, which is coming from, you know, those loans that we're talking about, how much the government spends on whatever it's doing, and what our foreign trade balance is. And so out of all of that, the government seems to be saying, well, okay, all of those are fine, but we don't want to, you know, we can't do anything about foreign trade balance. We don't want to spend any more as a government. We would like companies to invest more because that's going to help them to increase their output. And we'd like people to spend more, which gets back to our fundamental question. How do you spend more if you haven't got enough money, if you haven't got any more money sitting in your bank account?
Yeah, so
first and foremost,
Richie Sunak is stuck in the rhetoric world yet again. And it says, you know, exhortations can get you to become more productive. No, you need money. And you have to be encouraging that money to be spent in investment or skills development, because a lot of this, you're not going to be using this new technology unless you are part of the information system, learning how to use the technology and being able to develop it rather than having to import it. So you need investment money, and you need money for education. And he's trying desperately not to provide either.
Yeah, you need to increase the money supply. Very simple. Mm. All right. I mean, and obviously, if you increase the money supply too much, too fast, then you do get an inflation problem.
You get a potential one. This is one that'll, I mean, I've had this fight so many times, I just thought I'm going to have a bit of fun and take over the National Rifle Association's line. And of course, they have that line that says that guns don't kill people, people kill people. So I'm going to have money doesn't create inflation, people create inflation. And that's true, because the extent to which firms are going to be willing to put up their prices will depend by putting up their markups, will depend on how buoyant they think the economy is. And when you look back at the data for the pandemic, what happened there was a dramatic increase in government money. And that's, we might as well actually give some numbers on that front. We've been talking around this, but haven't actually spoken about it. But there was an enormous increase in the level of M1 money in America, almost by a factor of six during the pandemic. When you look at the broad money, you started, let's just get the number here for the America. In January of 2020, there was $15.4 trillion in broad money. That's January. And we go to April, let's go to September. So you went from 15.4 at the beginning of the year, I'll go through to the end of the year, to 20. There were 25% increase in the amount of money. Now, at the same time, the impact of that was a dramatic, it kept the economy going through that period because people could pay their financial commitments with it. But you had a corresponding, not quite, but a dramatic fall in the velocity of money circulation.
Because they couldn't spend on stuff. Yeah. And then the inflation happens because what money there is swilling around, well, the government is spending it trying to buy equipment to help combat, you know, PCE and stuff like that, or PPE, I should say. And, you know, so obviously price of PPE goes up. Same as if you've got demand for anything, if the government...
But that again comes back to the... Who create the government? The money in circuit, the additional money enables the thought of putting up your markup. But the person who put the markup is normally a member of the House of Lords.
Well, it certainly was in that case, wasn't it? But I mean, that is the problem. If you create the extra money, who's getting the money and what are they going to spend it on? And if all of them want to spend it on, and it happens suddenly, and they all want to spend it on something which there's a shortage of supply, then of course you're going to get inflation. So it has to be managed well. But you have to increase the money supply if you are going to get economic growth. That's the takeout, isn't it?
Yeah.
And hopefully we've explained it simply, Steve. I think we have this week for once.
I'm not so sure. Have to see what our critic writes back to us and says.
All right. Anyway, good to catch you again. Catch you next week. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y-Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y-Curve in your favourite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.